Okay, so today is Tuesday, February 11th. We're looking at coronary circulation. That is page 37 in the course pack. In class on Thursday of last week, we talked about a way for the heart itself to nourish the myocardium with blood. And there's a major vessel on here that takes oxygenated blood away from the heart. Which large vessel emerges that does that job?
Aorta.
Aorta, good. So it makes sense that the heart itself would nourish from blood taken from that aorta. So if we take the cover off here, you probably saw there were two little stumps here on either side, and they were representing two of those coronary arteries. These coronary arteries actually do link back up to the aorta, and they barb some of that oxygenated blood away from the aorta. And you probably could see them pretty clearly laying on the surface of the heart. So they do travel around these grooves or sulcuses on the heart. They nourish the myocardium with oxygenated blood. Now, when the heart is done with that oxygenated blood, we've got to send it back through veins. And which vein is the one that most likely catches the blood for the heart?
Coronary sinus,
yeah, back here on the back side. So that is a major vein that picks up blood from coronary circulation. And like the SVC and IVC, where does it take blood? What chamber?
Right atrium.
Right atrium, good. So we've got all three veins taking deoxygenated blood back into that right atrium. So just, a little detour for some blood that was traveling through the aorta goes through these coronary arteries on the surface. We'll learn in the next chapter that gas exchange will occur in the capillaries here and then eventually drain back into the coronary veins and that coronary sinus, okay? So in the heart model, you may have noticed what looks to be a little red spot there in the right atrium. Of course, that is the opening to that coronary sinus. All right, so any questions about coronary or cardiac circulation from last week? Okay. Let's see, page 38 is blood flow through the heart, so why don't we talk about that next? Okay, so first thing I want to point out is there's two circulations going on here when we cover blood flow. There is a systemic circulation and there's a pulmonary circulation. Alternately, we can call them a systemic circuit and a pulmonary circuit. So when we talk about blood flow, we actually do tie in that systemic pathway and the pulmonary pathway. So we have to keep in mind what the two terms indicate. The term pulmonary means we're taking blood to and from what location? Back and forth to the lungs, right. And what about a systemic pathway? Where does that take us? Out to the body and back, right. So we'll include that in our pathway as we walk through here on page 38, that blood flow. All right, so I'm just going to start you with a place that makes sense, but like I mentioned in class last week, you're going to want to feel comfortable picking any starting point for blood flow and then wrapping it back to that starting point. There's about 20 or so structures here for you to be looking through. And probably one of the easiest ways to learn blood flow, if you're uncomfortable with it, is just getting a model or a picture and walking yourself through. You guys had this on lab test, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is this something you're pretty much comfortable with?
No.
No? Okay, so let's run through it and make sure you get that comfort level here with this. We're going to start with SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus. That's going to just be the place that I'm going to pick for us to start today. And these are three veins that carry deoxygenated blood back into the right atrium. From the right atrium, that blood travels through an open tricuspid valve, and it drains down into our right ventricle. From there, blood flows up through and pushes open this pulmonary semilunar valve. You're welcome to call it SLV for semilunar valve for short. And from the pulmonary semilunar valve, where do we go next? Good, pulmonary trunk. That trunk is going to split into some pulmonary arteries. Those pulmonary arteries take us to pulmonary arterioles, which are simply smaller arteries. Those arterioles branch into our very smallest vessels known as pulmonary capillaries. Those pulmonary capillaries are the site of gas exchange in the lungs. What gas are we dropping off to get rid of?
CO2.
Yeah, dump the CO2, and you're trying to pick up which gas?
Oxygen.
Pick up oxygen. So we do that gas exchange at those pulmonary capillaries. Now we head back toward the heart in pulmonary venules and pulmonary veins. We just completed the pulmonary circuit. We just took the blood to the lungs, dropped off that CO2, and picked up the oxygen. Okay, so we just finished a pulmonary circuit. Now, you come back to the heart in these four major pulmonary veins and arrive in which chamber?
Left atrium.
Left atrium, good. We travel through an open mitral or bicuspid valve. The blood now drains down into this left ventricle. Upon contraction of that left ventricle, blood is pushed out through another valve. This one here called what?
Aortic semilunar.
Good. Aortic semilunar valve. You can call it SLV for short if you like. And now we travel out through the aorta. We're heading on which pathway now?
Systemic.
Yeah, you're going to the body now. The aorta is our largest artery. It does carry blood to all destinations, and of course it branches off into smaller vessels known as arteries, and then arterioles, and then finally capillaries. Capillaries are special because they're thin-walled and they're the site of gas exchange in the body. And so when we do this, now we're dropping off oxygen to the body's cells and tissues, and we're picking up what waste product?
CO2.
Pick up the CO2. So pick up that CO2, put it back in the veins, let it come back toward teeny tiny venules. They join with larger veins, and ultimately those veins dump blood in one of two major systemic veins. You've got this one down here known as the inferior vena cava, and the one coming in on the top side is, you know, SVC or superior vena cava. So it takes about a minute to do this journey from our starting point all the way around those circuits back to our starting point once again. So it's about a minute for blood to circulate. I do want to remind this point that we talked about in here last class period, and that's the fact that blood comes into your right atrium and your left atrium at the very same time. Even though we're talking this through as if we were following a blood cell, I don't want to give the wrong idea. You're not just having blood flow through like a snake. It's draining both atria through both mitral and tricuspid, yeah, same time down into the ventricles. So even though we're following it in a pathway, you want to continue to think of it as a simultaneous process. Okay, again, one more time. Okay, let's pick somewhere else to start. Go ahead, Annie.
I'm sorry. Are you able to go over the gas exchange at the pulmonary?
Sure.
The capillaries?
When we're coming from the right ventricle, we're taking deoxygenated blood. That's key because it's full of that carbon dioxide that we want to get rid of. Because when we're coming from the right ventricle, pulmonary trunk to pulmonary arteries, arterioles, the capillaries is where that actual gas exchange occurs in the lungs. Not on this picture, of course, because we're not really into that chapter yet. But your job in the lungs is to drop off the CO2. That's a waste product. And to pick up the oxygen. And that is actually opposite to what's going to happen in our capillaries at the systemic level. I didn't notate the details there, but in the systemic capillaries, this time we're dropping off oxygen and we're picking up the CO2, so it's an opposite gas exchange. Okay, so in the lungs, you're getting rid of the CO2, you're dropping it off. Your job is to pick up the oxygen in the lungs. But systemically, it's an opposite process. That time, you're going to drop off the oxygen and pick up the CO2. Good. Okay. So let's do this again. We'll do it in order, and then we'll mix up a little bit and pick a different starting point. So let's pick the SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus. Those three are going to be our starting point this time around. And they dump blood back into which chamber?
Right atrium.
Right atrium, good. Blood now flows through an open valve called?
Tricuspid
valve. It flows down into which chamber?
Right ventricle.
Now to go up through another valve? Good. And then to the pulmonary trunk? And then where? Good. Pulmonary arteries take us to the lungs. So we go arteries, arterioles, capillary, Venules, then veins. And then we're back to these four red veins here, and they don't us in which chamber? Good. And from there, we travel through another open valve. This one is called?
Bicuspid.
You got it, yeah, bicuspid or mitral, down into the?
Left
ventricle. Up through another valve. Good. And then now we're in the aorta. And then from the aorta, we go through arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, veins, back to the starting point, SVC, IVC, coronary sinus, back into the right atrium. So we can pick any point as our starting place. So we could say, hey, let's pick the aorta as our starting point, and let's just run that through. If aorta is your starting point, where do you go next?
Arteries.
Arterioles.
Good. SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. You got it from there? Okay. So just be comfortable starting at any point on this whole flow pattern for the test. I might say to you, hey, let's start with the aorta, or let's start with SVC, IVC, coronary sinus, and just use that as your place that you come back to when you finish the pathway. Okay. So if this is not something you're 100% comfortable with, I do highly recommend a picture. This one's a good one. It's got the arrows directing you in the right pathway. Or get a model from lab and sit and look at that. I think using a picture or an image will help you master this pathway. Is there anything I can address for you on page 38? Any questions I can answer? Do you understand the difference between systemic and pulmonary circuits? Okay, so which one goes to the lungs? And where does systemic circuit take you?
To the
body. Good. All right, so it looks like we're ready for page 39. Nonetheless, the information hasn't changed that much over the past decade. In this picture, you're looking at the dark red colors. Those are indicating higher levels of heart disease. And unfortunately, the whole southeast here looks like it's just covered in some dark red. That tells us that we have a quite high incidence of heart disease around here. In fact, they call this the stroke belt. We've been called the diabetes belt, the heart disease belt. There's bunches of intermingled diseases that go hand in hand. Of course, diabetes can lead to heart disease, and heart disease can lead to things like stroke. So unfortunately, this is not good for us to be in this bright red color down here, but that is the nature of what's happening in this area. All right, so let's talk about cardiac conduction system, because this is what can be damaged if you have heart disease. If you have, say, a heart attack, then this process of getting the heart to contract in a rhythmic process can be damaged. And like we talked in our last class period, there is no way to repair damaged heart muscle tissue, so unfortunately, damage is scar tissue. And that's how this particular damaged tissue will be replaced, just with collagen fibers. So there's actually a set of controlling systems here that manage the heart rate for us. And one of those heart rate controlling systems is a built-in system. It's called an intrinsic conduction system. So I'm sure you've heard of Frankenstein before, right? Okay, so it's kind of like a Frankenstein concept. Most of our organs, if taken out of our bodies, wouldn't operate without the body as a whole nourishing it. But the heart, left up to itself, if you put it into like a saline solution, it can beat by itself. How Frankenstein creepy is that? So it has its own built-in conducting system, and that's what we call this intrinsic nervous system. So there's a set of wirings, you might say, a nervous system set up inside the heart muscle tissue that ensures that the heart will beat at its own pace. All right, so here's how this works. There are little nodules of nervous tissue scattered in your heart throughout this myocardium. The fastest set of nervous tissue is the one that sets the pace. And for most of us, that's going to be about 75 beats per minute. So it's the winner that gets to set the pace for the heart rate. Okay? So as we age, sometimes other pieces of nodal tissue will become the fastest, and of course that then becomes the one that sets the heart rate. So people may have a heart rate that's resting at, say, 100 beats per minute or 125 beats per minute, and we say, we probably guess that that SA node is no longer in control if you've got such a fast heart rate. So for most of us, that SA node or sinoatrial node is the fastest piece of nervous tissue, and it should be the one setting the pace for the heartbeat. And because it sets the pace, what name do we give to the SA node? Call it the pacemaker. Yeah. So it's kind of like the drum major. It sets the beat, it sets the pace. Okay, so this pacemaker or SA node is in the right atrium. Ah, right atrium. Where does it get blood from? All whole body, right? SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. So it seems to make sense that when blood comes back into the right atrium of the heart, that right atrium sets the pace for how fast the heart's going to pump that blood through. We also have another node. You might call it number two in charge, and it's called the AV node. AV is short for atrioventricular node. It actually sits down below the right atrium, close to that interventricular septum wall. And that AV node sets the pace at around 40 to 60 beats per minute. But it's not the fastest piece of nervous tissue in the heart, so it must follow the pace of the SA node. So it's going to follow the pace of that 75 beats per minute. The reason I mention number two in charge is who takes over if the SA node fails? And what does your pace now become?
Slower.
Slower, yeah. So if somebody's natural heart rate, and I'm not talking about like an Olympic style athlete, I'm just talking about just your random person, okay, now has a heart rate of, say, 50 beats per minute. Makes us wonder, hey, was that SA node still in charge, or has something happened to it that the AV node is now the faster of the pieces of nodal tissue? So because it is number two in charge, it's our second fastest piece of nervous tissue. That's going to be actually a slow heart rate. It's too slow for us to operate under normal conditions. All right, so the pacemaker is your SA node. In what chamber is it located?
Right atrium.
Right atrium, good. And about how many beats per minute do you think it sets the pace?
75.
Good. It's going to set that pace at about 75 beats per minute. Okay, so there's a blank there for you to fill in. Normal resting heart rate is 75 beats per minute. And the normal range is 60 to 100 beats per minute. So let's take a detour conversation for just a moment. You've probably heard that exercise is good for your heart, right? Okay. So what it does for your heart muscle tissue is it takes this myocardium and it stretches it. The more you exercise, the more that heart muscle tissue has to stretch. And when you exercise, you're forcing this blood through the heart at a faster pace. If you're doing this, the heart muscle tissue stretches and it has to snap back really efficiently to pump the blood out of the heart. You know, think of your heart like a rubber band. If you have a flabby, worn-out rubber band, what happens when you stretch that flabby rubber band?
It stays stretched.
And when you let go of it, it just kind of slinks. Yeah, it doesn't really snap back into position. So if you've got a worn-out heart, you know, when you stretch it, when blood comes through, it doesn't snap back into tension to get that blood pumped out. So exercise will increase the contractility. That's how that snap back that we want to take place works. You want exercise to make your heart, muscle tissue snap back into position. If you exercise routinely and you do a lot of cardio where you're forcing your heart to do some work, then over time, your heart says, I know what happens. When I stretch, you want me to snap back and do it really well. And that really forces that blood and it exits it out of both of these two arteries here on top of the heart. Now, if you do this on a routine basis, your resting heart rate may lower below 75 beats per minute. Your resting heart rate may be 60 beats per minute. And if you're working out a lot, It may be 50 beats per minute or 45 beats per minute. Some Olympic athletes who work out, 8 hours a day have resting heart rates in the 30s and 40s. And you might look at that and say, whoa, something's wrong here, right? Sounds like the AV node's in charge. But in fact, their hearts have enlarged and that muscle tissue has become very efficient at snapping back. So when the blood comes through, the heart stretches and it makes a very efficient contraction to push the blood out. So I don't want to give the idea that a resting heart rate of 35 is a bad thing. It's okay if you're an Olympic type athlete, you work out 8 hours a day. But if you're not one of those people who works out 8 hours a day and have really well-toned bodies and very little fat, then we look at 35 beats per minute and we say, oh, that sounds like which term on your paper? Bradycardia. Yeah. So bradycardia is actually slower than 60, there's your blank, slower than 60 beats per minute. Slower than 60 beats per minute. So for the rest of us who have to work for a living and don't have 8 hours a day to work out and have a really well-toned heart, 60 beats per minute or slower might indicate there's something going on. A lot of people do take medications that will give them a set of bradycardia heart rates. That may be normal for them. That may be the goal that the heart doctor is going for. But if you're just somebody who's not being medicated or somebody who's not a well-toned athlete, then something slower than 60 beats per minute means that we have bradycardia. What is the problem for having such a slow heart rate?
Lack of blood flow.
Lack of blood flow. So this person might be tired. How else might they feel?
Cold.
Cold.
Sleepy.
Sleepy. And maybe not getting enough oxygen to their body's organ cells, tissues. So that's certainly an issue for something that's a slow heart rate. Let's flip the tables and go the opposite direction. Tachycardia. That means a fast heart rate. Above how many beats per minute?
100.
Good. During exercise, we anticipate our heart rates heading up above 100 beats per minute, and that should be normal for exercise. In fact, we have a target heart rate somewhere probably in the 130s, 140s, 150s, that we should max out the efficiency for our hearts pumping that blood through. But under normal resting conditions, what is the problem with having your heart beating 110 beats per minute just sitting at your desk? What happens over time?
It gets
worn out. Yeah. So if you're not exercising and for some reason your heart is beating really fast, then a really fast heart rate at rest can wear your heart out over time. So they'll give you medication to slow your heart rate down, which is what I had. I had a resting heart rate of 95 beats per minute, and they put me on the stress test. Normally it takes 15 minutes to reach your heart goal, 140, 145 beats per minute, 15 seconds. So I've got what they call supraventricular tachycardia. It means that my heart runs fast. Maybe it's an underlying adrenal issue. I have hyperthyroidism, so there's some mechanism going on there. But I take a beta blocker that keeps my resting heart rate closer to 75, because had I stayed at 95 beats per minute, gonna wear that heart out. It becomes big, flabby, and big, flabby hearts don't work very well. So that's why keeping it around 75 means that we're nourishing those cells and tissues with a good enough level of oxygen. Okay, so where's the SA node?
Right atrium.
And what's its job?
Keep the pace.
Keep the pace. At about how many beats per minute?
75.
Good. Is that at rest or during exercise?
Rest.
That's at rest. Good. And what's the alternate name for the SA node? Pacemaker. Good. And who's number two in charge if the pacemaker's not doing its job?
AV
node. And is its rate faster or slower?
Slower.
At about how many beats per minute?
40 to 60.
Yeah, 40 to 60. So that puts us in the range of having what condition?
Bradycardia.
Yeah, bradycardia. Okay, so let me walk you through down about halfway of your page. It says intrinsic conduction system pathway. Let me walk you through how this works. In just a minute, I'll come back and hit number two here, autonomic nervous system control. Let's take care of intrinsic pathway first. Okay, So we know the SA node is the point of the pacemaker, and you can see it's a little node of nervous tissue right up here at the top of your right atrium. In fact, it sits close to where that SVC dumps blood back into the heart. Now, I'm going to take you back to Bio-210 with me for just a moment. You've heard of terms like depolarization, action potential, repolarization, right? Okay, so before we talk about depolarized, repolarized contraction, let's just do a little quick cheat sheet over here. Does depolarization mean the heart is currently contracting?
Yeah.
Or it's getting ready to contract?
Getting ready to contract.
And what channels are open right now letting ions? Sodium channels. Good. So sodium channels open. Sodium enters myocardium. That pen's almost done. Okay, so I want to make the point that depolarization means that we're leading up to the contraction event. It is not the contraction event, because that comes when we've got enough sodium into that cell to reach threshold. So once we've reached threshold, we expect for that action potential to radiate through the muscle cells of the heart and cause a heart contraction. Okay, and then of course, we've got to clean up this mess because we let sodium ions rush into our cell. During what event do we escort them back out?
Repolarization.
Good. All right, so that sodium-potassium pump operates during repolarization. And what happens to your muscle tissue during repolarization? Is it gearing up for contraction, or is it going back to a resting state?
Resting state.
Good. Returning to a resting state or relaxing. Okay. So I just want to make sure we were speaking the same language, since this does have to do with what's going to happen in this conduction system. Okay, so where's that SA node located? And what's its job?
Pacemaker.
Good. Sets the pace for the heart's contraction rate. At rest, that's about how many beats per minute?
75.
Good. That SA node does not need anybody to tell it what to do. Not your brain, not any part of your body tells that SA node what to do. It says, I run the show for the heart. Nobody has to tell me when to set the pace. So I want to make that point because we so often talk about the brain and the spinal cord running how your body works. Not here. This SA node says, I'm in charge of this heart. I set the pace. I do my own thing. So it's going to initiate a nerve impulse that tells your two atria to depolarize and then contract. You can see they're showing us in yellow here a set of nerves that travel through the myocardium of your right and your left atrium. And the goal is for them to more or less simultaneously depolarize and then contract together. So when they're depolarizing, they're getting ready to contract, and of course that's followed by an atrial contraction. Where does blood go from each atrium when it contracts? Down into the ventricles, right. And for that blood to travel through those two valves on either side, those valves must be hanging there open. So when the right atrium gets the nerve impulse to contract and the left atrium, they simultaneously contract, They push blood through these open valves and it collects down here in these two ventricles. So we've got about as much blood in each ventricle as we can handle at this time. And so now we're waiting for the message to hit the second charge, this AV node. So the AV node has to listen to the SA node. Why? Who's in charge here? Because it comes first and it's the fastest. So even though the AV node would normally set the pace around 40 to 60 beats per minute, it says, I have to do what the SA node tells me to because it sets the pace. It's faster than my normal depolarization rate. So the AV node is going to receive a message from the SA node. And that's going to be about every 75 beats per minute. So when the AV node gets told, hey, your turn, it's your job, you're up now, it now sends an impulse through this set of nerves that travels down the interventricular septum and up the walls of those ventricles. You'll notice that right here when we cross into the interventricular septum, they call this the bundle. The old name for it is the bundle of His. It's named after somebody. But nowadays they call it the interventricular bundle, or, you know, they get more of a location name for it rather than just using the person's name. Nonetheless, this is a bundle. And the pieces that come off of it are called bundle branches. So if you've ever heard of bundle blockages or bundle branch blockages, that's what we're talking about, is somewhere in this conduction pathway. You'll notice that each of these branches comes down to this point here, the apex, and they travel up the walls of the ventricles. Now they terminate in these nerve endings called Purkinje fibers. Okay, so let me hit you from the top and we'll travel it all the way through now. The SA node sets the pace. It fires a nerve impulse that travels to the right and the left atrium. That nerve impulse tells your atria to depolarize, and then they contract. That sends blood through open AV valves and down into your ventricles. At about that time, the message will now arrive at your AV node. Your AV node now receives the message. It fires off an impulse that travels the bundle of His down the branches here in the interventricular septum and up the walls in the Purkinje fibers. Now, those Purkinje fibers release a neurotransmitter that tells your two ventricles to depolarize and contract. And again, we want them to contract simultaneously, and then when they do, where does the right ventricle eject blood?
Up the pulmonary trunk.
Up the pulmonary trunk, and then where does the left ventricle eject blood to? Out through the aorta. Okay, so this whole process that I've walked you through is actually less than a second's time. This cycle that we're talking about is actually about a 0.8 second cycle. If you do the math, that works out to around 75 beats per minute. So this process of having the SA node fire, atria contract, AV node fire, and ventricles contract, less than a second for all of that to take place. If you do the math, you know, 75 times a minute times 60 minutes an hour times however many minutes in a day. Oh my gosh, that's staggering. How many times your heart must beat in a lifetime. Wow, no wonder we don't want it to get worn out because, you know, this has got to last us quite a while. All right, so I do want to mention something in particular here. When I told you the story, I mentioned that the SA node had to fire first and which chambers depolarize and contract in response to that. Yeah, left atrium, right atrium. They're going to depolarize and contract. And where are they sending their blood? Into the ventricles. Good. And we want those ventricles to fill with blood. What if your SA node and your AV node fire at the same time? What would happen to your atria and your ventricles at the same time?
They contract together.
They'd all contract together. And what are we trying to send out on a pulmonary and a systemic circuit? Blood. And if you have those ventricles contracting before they're full of blood, then you're not sending blood out to their destinations. So there's actually a pause in the mechanism here. When you have the SA node fire, you want your atria to depolarize, you want your atria to contract, and that blood to go down into your two ventricles.
It's the love dog.
It's that love dog. Because if you don't pause, then you don't fill your ventricles with enough blood. And then you're not sending an adequate amount out into circulation. So before that AV node fires, there's a pause. Because we want to make sure we've had adequate time to send that blood down into those two ventricles. Okay? So if you were sending blood too quickly down there, you didn't fill the ventricles up, and the ventricles got the message to contract, you wouldn't be pumping enough out for your systemic or your pulmonary circuit. And that's not good news. So that's how exercise actually makes your heart work more efficiently. When these walls are stretched with blood, we want them to stretch efficiently and then also contract back efficiently. Doing so not like a flabby rubber band, but like a sharp, brand new rubber band. Have them come back with force. Okay. So SA node fires, atria depolarize and contract. AV node fires, here we go down the bundle branches, the Purkinje fibers. Let's wait for it to catch up. And when we hit the Purkinje fibers, they send a neurotransmitter onto that myocardium. And what does the myocardium do?
Contracts.
It then contracts. So the whole point of this intrinsic conduction system is to set a rate at 75 beats per minute. And it's also to ensure which chambers contract first.
Atria.
And which chambers contract second?
Ventricles.
And why must there be a delay between atrial contraction and ventricular contraction? Yeah, got to fill the ventricles with enough blood, got to have enough pressure in there to adequately pump that blood out. So we want to be a little timely here, a little bit of a delay between the SA node firing and the timing for that AV node to fire. All right, so this is called the intrinsic conduction system. This is a built-in cardiac conduction system. There is no part of your brain that has to tell this system to work. It's all done unto itself, using this built-in nervous tissue. Kind of freaky, right? Okay, so let's go back to this slide, and this will take you to the very bottom of your page now. So sometimes your brain needs to override the SA node. So imagine life before modern times. You know, you might have been exposed to wild animals. You might have had to run for your life. You might have had to hunt for your food, and that was the only way you ate. So imagine life before modern times. Stress was actually real stress, not the psychological stress we have from modern lifetime. So if you think about the necessity to stay alive, like perhaps to run from an animal or to hunt and run after an animal, then we might need the sympathetic nervous system to speed up our heart rate. So we do have an outside system that can influence your heart rate and cause it to either increase in speed or decrease in speed. So if you need to increase your heart rate, you need a way to tell that SA node, hey, 75 beats per minute just ain't cutting it. You need to be about twice that. And so we can dump epinephrine and norepinephrine onto that SA node and get it to speed up. So we can have a sympathetic response that will cause our heart rates to increase. You'll notice that we also can decrease our heart rate using the parasympathetic nervous system. And this time we use the vagus nerve. Oh, the vagus nerve. What do you remember about it?
It's your brain and your stomach.
Brain and stomach, yeah. It's a cranial nerve, right? Which cranial nerve?
10.
Good. What's weird about the vagus nerve? Most cranial nerves serve what part of your body? Your head. Right. And this cranial nerve is actually one that wanders, which is where the name vagus comes from. It wanders away from your head and it travels to your heart and as far down as your, you know, digestive and your urinary organs. Now, the heart is special because if the vagus nerve is in control of your heart, then what happens to your heart rate? It slows. So if you've heard about doing meditation or yoga or things that put you into a restful state of mind, you are putting the parasympathetic nervous system in charge over your heart rate. And that can help to lower your heart rate. So which neurotransmitter do you think is telling the heart to slow? Yeah, acetylcholine, ACH. All right, so vagus nerve, ACH, slows the heart rate. And this may come as a surprise to you, but of these two systems here, sympathetic and parasympathetic, it's actually the parasympathetic that is meant to dominate your heart rate and keep it slower. We have enough to increase our heart rate, right? So parasympathetic is the one that should be the one that dominates. That's why they recommend things like meditation and yoga, because those are some of the fewest things that can actually lower that heart rate and put that vagus nerve in charge. Almost everything else we do puts us into sympathetic territory. Y'all so far so good on that page? So how do you know if you've got this down pat? Get a picture like this one and walk yourself through it. So if you can start with the SA node and tell me what it does from there, and then take me to the AV node and talk me through the next step of the process, then you've got the process, and it's just a story. Okay, so let's do it one more time before we head into EKGs. Which node of tissue has to fire first to set the pace? Good. And where is it located? Good. And its normal pace rate is how many beats per minute?
75.
Okay, and when that SA node fires, what two chambers depolarize first? Right atrium, left atrium. And of course, when they depolarize, their next step is to contract. When they contract, where do they send blood? Right ventricle, left ventricle. And these two valves, of course, have to be open at this time. Now we're down here filling up these two ventricles, and about that time, the AV node gets a nerve impulse. There's a delay in that nerve impulse arriving at the AV node. For what reason? Got to let those ventricles fill up with blood. So now that the AV node got the message, the nerve impulse travels through this bundle of His. It splits into these bundle branches down the interventricular septum. And what's the last stop?
Purkinje fibers.
Good. The Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine onto those nerve, onto those muscle cells, and those muscle cells in the ventricles now contract. So blood from the right ventricle is ejected through what vessel? Good. Pulmonary semilunar valve takes us to the pulmonary trunk, and blood from the left ventricle takes you to
aorta.
Good. So we've got to have enough blood in there to send it out for systemic and for pulmonary circuits. How long did that cycle take?
0.8 seconds.
Okay. And if you flip over to page 40 with me, we're going to map that out, that EKG, which is basically tracing this electrical activity. So your typical EKG is 0.8 seconds. That means from the time that it starts to the time that your next heartbeat initiates. So let me give you some history on EKG readings. EKG or ECG, however you like to say it, is an electrocardiogram. It's a tracing of the heart's electrical activity. Anytime you see upward spikes, that just indicates that the nerve impulse is coming toward the electrode. We can do as few as 3 electrodes. We can do as many as like 12 or 15 electrodes. So that upward spike is just traveling towards some particular electrode. A downward spike means the nerve impulse is traveling away from that electrode. I want to make this point because we oftentimes think an upward spike means an influx of something and a downward spike means something else. But that's not the case here. It just simply tells us that's where the nerve impulse is traveling. It's traveling either toward an electrode or away from an electrode. So we can't really infer anything else but that. Now, if somebody set up the EKG backwards and we see the spikes going up when they should be going down and vice versa, you know right off the bat the electrode was set up in the wrong position. Okay. There is also a baseline on an EKG. That's what we call it, the zero point line. It's a 0 millivolt line. And we're actually measuring these electrical spikes up and down in millivolt charges. Now, back when you did Bio-210, you may have heard of the resting rate for a muscle or a nerve cell, somewhere between 50 and 90 is what we consider to be a resting millivolt charge. So that's what we're looking at here, is these charges traveling in that millivolt range. Anybody still need this slide? Okay, I'll hang here for a second for you. Okay, anyone still need this slide? Okay. You know, nowadays EKGs are all hooked to a computer. They're electronic. There's really no need to print out a paper strip unless you want to add one to a file. But I did want to indicate what's going on when you look at EKGs. They're always printed on a graph if you've got one printed out. And that graph is actually indicative of time. So when you look at this picture, you'll notice teeny tiny blocks. This little teeny tiny block here is actually part of a bigger set of blocks, okay? So when you look at a bigger set of blocks, you'll notice that that is, over here, equal to about 0.2 seconds. So when this paper was moving through an EKG machine, it was moving at a rate of about 0.2 seconds through the machine. And that's important because we're watching this unfold, and we know the cycle at rest should be about 0.8 seconds, okay? Now, if you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these big boxes, then each of those is 0.2 seconds. There's another 0.2, another 0.2, and so on. This whole thing that you're looking at here is equivalent to 1 second. And that's a tad bit longer than we would expect for the entire cardiac cycle to circulate back through to the next one, okay? So we don't really need to worry about the teeny tiny boxes. Instead, we're going to focus that a big box is about 0.2 seconds. And the cardiac cycle is itself about 0.8 seconds. And what I mean by a cardiac cycle is what?
A heartbeat.
A heartbeat, right. So every time your atria ventricles contract and then they do it again, that's a heartbeat. All right, so let's talk about the waves here. They go in order, starting with P, Q, R, S, T. There's even a U wave, but we're not really going to focus on that one. We're mainly going to focus on P, Q, R, S, and the T wave, and that's it. So just keep in mind they're in alphabetic order, and the heart rate actually starts, or the heartbeat starts with that P wave. Why don't we do this? Why don't we get rid of the screen? Okay. So this P wave right here is actually where we see atrial depolarization. Now, we just went through that intrinsic conduction system. What node of tissue tells your atria to depolarize? SA node. So the SA node must have just fired. And in fact, it did. It fired right before that P wave showed up. Okay, so I'm going to put a note there that says SA node fired right before that P wave. That's what tells those atria to depolarize. So what do we mean by depolarization? Good. Sodium's rushing in. The P process of getting ready to contract is going on. We're not quite there yet. We're getting close to threshold. So that's what we see here during the P wave. This P wave simply tells us that the atria are depolarizing. So let's go back through that cardiac cycle one more time. When we know the SA node fires, it tells your atria to depolarize. And immediately after they depolarize, they contract. You actually don't see a wave here for atrial contraction. That's because it's hidden behind the next huge wave, which is that QRS wave. So I'm just going to make a note that atrial contraction is hidden here. A wave for the atrial contraction. If we were to see a wave, it would be hiding behind that QRS complex. Atrial contraction is hidden. Yeah, because that's blocking off QRS, and so it's hidden back behind there.
Okay.
You're right, hidden down below because it's on top of a word. So you actually don't see any event for atrial contraction. You wouldn't anyway, because this is nothing more than sodium ions rushing down the length of those muscle cells. It's not the influx or the outflow of any ions. So you really wouldn't expect to see anything corresponding to it. But nonetheless, we know where it should be occurring, and it's behind that QRS wave. So let's start from the top. We know the SA node fires first, your atria depolarize, that's exhibited by our P wave. And then we know our atria contract hidden behind the QRS wave. In the meantime, the second in charge receives the nerve impulse, and it now depolarizes. What is your number two node of tissue?
AV node.
AV node. So where is it firing on this EKG? Right in there, right before that QRS wave starts. So when the AV node fires, the nerve impulse travels down the bundle of His, down the bundle branches to the Purkinje fibers, and the Purkinje fibers release acetylcholine onto those myocardial cells. Those muscle cells now in the ventricle begin to depolarize, and because there's a lot more muscle tissue down there, you see a much bigger wave. What's the wave we're looking at?
QRS.
You got it. QRS means ventricles depolarize. QRS is where your ventricles depolarize. So on your worksheet it says, why is the QRS wave so large in comparison to the P wave? They're both depolarization events, but you've got more muscle tissue in those ventricles. That's one reason the QRS wave is so big. And another reason is you've got to have a greater depolarization event because you've got more muscle tissue. So more sodium must rush into those cells in terms of, you know, percentage. So you've got more muscle tissue down there in those ventricles. Huh. Well, I'm not going to say a wave for ventricular contraction. It's going to occur at some point between S and T. But you are going to see a wave for ventricular repolarization. What wave represents that event? T wave. So let's circle, and that's going to be our ventricular repolarization. Okay, so T wave means the ventricles are repolarizing. Cycle back to the beginning once again now that we're about finished with the process of contraction. You don't need to know U wave, but I wouldn't tell you. It's papillary muscle repolarization, but it's not an important part of the EKG force. We're focusing on P, Q, R, S, and T. But if you'd like to make a note, U is simply for papillary muscle repolarization. How long is this cycle?
0.8
seconds. 0.8 seconds. And that equates to how many beats per minute?
75.
Good. And which wave shows up in response to the SA node firing?
P wave.
And when the AV node fires, now what wave shows up?
QRS.
And do you see a wave for atrial contraction or ventricular contraction?
No.
Neither one. You only see waves here for the depolarization event and the repolarization event. And I should also mention the atrial contraction and repolarization, all that's hidden by that big, massive QRS wave. So that's why you don't actually have anything to label here for atrial repolarization. Feel okay with this? Any questions on it? How much time is a big box on here?
0.2 seconds.
I'm just going to make a note. One big box is 0.2 seconds. Okay. And we're going to keep that in mind as we look at the next page, which is some problems with EKGs. All right. Got your blanks filled in and everything? Sure. The real reason for having a bigger wave for the QRS is there's more muscle tissue in the ventricles. That leads to a larger depolarization event. Anybody need a picture? I'm going to pull the screen down. Good to go. I just want to point out a few problematic EKGs. These are serious ones to look at. Most of our EKG events that are fatal are looking at ventricular problems because, well, they pump blood out to the body and the lungs. So you'll want to recognize these as being able to name them and a brief description of them. For instance, this one here, flatline or asystole, you don't see any electrical activity of the heart. So in this case, we can't find any measurable waves, and that's probably because the SA node nor the AV node is taking charge of contracting that heart. Epinephrine may be given here, but it may not be very effective on the heart because it's not listening to anything. The SA node is just not responsive. Heart massage may be a way to go. If somebody's having open heart surgery, they may simply take a hand and massage the heart and manually contract to pump blood through the body. Paddles may be used here. Caution, of course, because there's no electrical activity. We're trying to get that heart to jumpstart. Within 5 minutes, the brain is going to be deprived of oxygen, so 15 minutes is far and clear a way to declare clinical death in this situation because there's been such a long time that those brain cells have been deprived of oxygen. So this is a pretty easy one to spot, asystole. This one is called third degree heart block, and what we're looking at is really far apart QRS waves. Now, I should mention to you that to consider it a heartbeat, a full-on heartbeat, we should have a QRS wave present. And if you count the peak here, this is an R peak right there. The next R peak comes quite a far distance away. So you'll notice in between, we've got P wave, P wave, P wave, P wave, P wave, and then finally another QRS wave. What does QRS wave tell us is happening with the heart? Ventricles are getting ready to contract. If you see no QRS wave, you don't anticipate a ventricular contraction. So what do these P waves tell us is happening?
SA
nodes send the signal, and who's not receiving it? AV node's probably not receiving it. So there's some blockage here, as implied by the name. There's no impulse sent down to the ventricles, and therefore they're just not getting the message that it's time for them to contract. So you'll notice the atria will beat around 60 to 100 beats per minute, which is normal, right? But the ventricles will beat much slower. So when you're feeling for a pulse, you're probably getting a slower pulse rate there because you're just not getting the blood ejected out into circulation. So unfortunately, a third degree or a heart block like this means that we have a very long time between sequential heartbeats. In fact, if you count, every big box here is how long? 0.2. Yep, so let's just do quickly. 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8. There is 1 second. 2, 4, 6, 8, 2 seconds. 2, 4, 6, 8, there's 3 seconds. Just estimating, there's about 5 seconds between those two heartbeats. So that gives us time for blood to start doing what? Could flow backwards. Blood that just sits and pulls loves to coagulate. So there's clot formation that we have to worry about. And most importantly, are your cells and tissues being nourished?
No.
Not in this condition. So this kind of a heart block here means that there's some interruption in that nerve impulse traveling down to those ventricles. This one is very easy to spot. It's called ventricular tachycardia. It's more dangerous than atrial tachycardia. Why do you think that's the case? They're beating really fast, the ventricles are beating really fast, and if they're beating really fast, what are they not having an opportunity to do? Get enough blood? And so what are they pumping out? Not enough blood, right? So if the atrial were having tachycardia, their main effect is the next door, which is going to be those ventricles down below. But the ventricles beating really fast, that affects our pulmonary circuit and our systemic circuit. That's big business here. So the peak here is the R wave peak, and we are going to count R peak to R peak to determine the length of that heartbeat. And this looks to be about 0.4 seconds. Well, if 0.8 seconds is 75 beats per minute, what is twice as fast? 150 beats per minute. And this is not 150 beats per minute during exercise. This is 150 beats per minute of dry pumping, right? There's not enough blood being pumped out into circulation. So this unfortunately means that cells and tissues again are being robbed of that oxygenated blood. They say the SA node's not in control. This is where we need, you know, to sink the ventricles back into circuit, so they're into what we call a sinus rhythm. This unfortunately can lead to death because we're just not pumping out oxygenated blood. All right, so VFib is also very dangerous. This too can lead to ventricular tachycardia, and that can lead to death. Can you spot a regular set of waves here? All right, so what does fibrillation mean? Kind of trembling, not really a routine rhythm, and that's exactly what you see, right? You don't see a routine rhythm. You do not see normal sinus rhythm, which is P, QRS, then T waves. So again, this means that there's some problem with getting the SNO to be in charge. If a person's had a heart attack, for instance, then that SNO may no longer be the one that's in control. Some other piece of nodal tissue may be trying to pony up and be the one in charge there. Atrial flutter is this one. It's less problematic than any ventricular problem. And let me go ahead and tell you that this one can become atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation can become problematic. So what do you see happening here around each P wave? So you see a little bit of fluttering before the P wave. That's where this one gets its name from. So it's kind of like a car engine trying to start. It just can't quite get turned over and get going. And again, the atria are contracting so quickly that the ventricles are not able to keep pace. So again, this puts problems out into terms of blood circulation, getting oxygenated blood into flow. Person with this condition may feel a little lightheaded, okay? And it's this sawtooth fluttery appearance that makes this one very easy to spot. This last one is atrial fibrillation, or AFib, and again, you tend to not see a very routine pattern to it. And the way they describe this one is it's irregular. So there's nothing normal about it. And if you take a moment and count with me, let's find the peaks of the R waves. Those are how we say that's where the ventricular contraction is getting ready to begin. That's where we're going to start counting. Looks like a big box here, 0.2, 0.4, 0.6. Here comes your next heartbeat. About 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8. There's your next heartbeat. 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8. 1 second, 1.2. There's your next heartbeat. There is nothing regular about the timing of these heartbeats, right? And then look in between those R waves. What kind of mess is this? Can you find a P or T wave in here? Nope. So what's happening is the atria flutter. Let me see, I've got a picture of an atrial. You can see over there the nerve impulses like echoing off the walls of the atria. And so they're just quivering and fluttering. Well, it's fibrillating here, actually. Unfortunately, that means that they're going so fast that they're not adequately pumping blood down into the ventricles. If you leave AFib alone, you could end up with stroke. Bad thing, bad news, right? And we can end up with people passing out, lightheadedness, dizziness, not getting enough oxygen to the brain. So even though AFib is something that people may walk around with and live with, it can be a life-threatening side effect of having stroke or other issues arise from it. So in this condition, they may do cardioversion. They temporarily put you to sleep for about 15 minutes. They shock the heart with the paddles, and they hope that gets the heart rate rhythm back into what they call normal sinus rhythm. Unfortunately, if left untreated, it can slip into other issues like things like stroke. Certain medications can also help to regulate AFib, and a person may not even know they have it. Something as simple as a sneeze can make a person who's prone to AFib slip back into this abnormal sinus rhythm. So even though AFib is a non-life-threatening one, it does have potentially lethal side effects to it. All right, so just a little bit on EKG abnormalities there. What you want to know about that page is to be able to recognize and name one of those conditions. All right, and let me get you started on page 42. This is something we're gonna practice a couple of times over to make sure that it gets comfortable for you. We're going to tie in blood pressure with this conversation. You'll notice a blood pressure chart at the top of the page. And so to start the conversation of blood pressure is the force exerted by your blood against the walls of your vessels. It is measured in mmHg. What does that mean? The Hg is mercury, right? And millimeters is mm. So it's the height of a column of mercury that the blood pressure can raise. That's why old-fashioned blood pressure devices actually have a column of mercury in there. You know, modern electronic ones don't have that same visible setup with that mercury, but nonetheless, that's what that reading comes from. When we talk about the numbers here, 120 over 80, we're looking at the pressure exerted by the ventricles here on top, that 120 number. And what is the 80 telling us? The relaxation phase, right. So technically, both of these are looking at ventricular contraction and relaxation. We call them systolic pressure for the ventricular contraction. We call them diastolic pressure for ventricular relaxation. But we're going to dive more into what that means, because both your atria and your ventricles are relaxing and contracting. Not exactly at the same time, but they're both doing it. Okay, so systolic pressure on top, diastolic pressure on the bottom. These pressures are measured in mmHg. That stands for millimeters mercury. And pressure is going to be the force of blood exerted against the walls of your vessels. And at the top of your page there, you'll notice that normal blood pressure is considered between 80 and 120 for systolic pressure and about 60 to 80 for diastolic pressure. I do want to make note that the American Heart Association says 110 is a better number than 120, and 70 is a better number than 80. So they consider 80 and 120 normal, but they say better numbers are 110 over 70. Why those numbers? Why 110 over 70? You're not pushing as hard, right? The heart's not pumping as hard. It's not contracting as hard. So they say 110 over 70, you still get the job done. It's just not the heart is not as pushing quite as hard getting that blood out in circulation. You'll want to note the pre-hypertension and hypertensive numbers there. Hypertensive crisis is above 180 over 110. And if you can, read ahead for Thursday. We're going to talk about diastole and systole, and we're going to incorporate these numbers into our conversation. That info is in your course pack 42 and 43. We'll try to see what we can do to wrap up most of this chapter on Thursday.
Pretty much everything's pre-hyper.